Okay, let's get back to some of the cures of this physical expressiveness thing. I should say this. There are lots of people out there who are offering courses for lawyers. You know, acting for lawyers, public speaking, this and that kind of thing. I think they all work. Somebody will give you an exercise to do that, you know, say, do tongue twisters, do this, get your imagination geared this way. All of that stuff works if you commit to it and if you do it. The problem with it is that most of us don't do it. You know, I have a tongue twister that I do all the time before I get up to speak. And it just warms me up. And I walk around as I'm shaving and getting dressed in the morning in my hotel room, and I do it. I say red leather, yellow leather, over and over and over to myself. And it's tough to say, and you trip on it. But if you're standing there and going, red leather, yellow leather, 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 you're warming up your mouth and you're getting ready to talk. I do that. Try it. It really helps. Do it in your car on the way to the courthouse. But we can't get away from the fact that despite those little glommed on remedies that we can get from courses like acting for lawyers, what we've got to focus on is that to feel comfortable in the communication, we've got to focus on what's going on between us. We've got to focus on the exchange of ideas. We've got to move off that notion that we will talk to the jury. You don't talk to the jury, you talk with the jury. Nobody likes to be talked at. People like to be talked with. And there's a psychological principle that goes like this. The more powerful you make the other person feel, the more cooperative they are. If you try to take away somebody's power and say, hey, I'm the hot shot here, you focus on me, I'll tell you what to think, you're gone. They're not going to stay with you for very long. But if you take what I call the sort of Columbo approach, let's think about this. I got a problem with this. Does it bother you that? What? Does it make sense? Let's talk about this. Can, you know, think this through with me. You know, you're giving them power. They become an equal player. And boy, they stay with you when you're doing that kind of stuff. You're talking with them about things. Almost any argument that you make can be rethought and reshaped in terms of, go through this with me. Well, let's look at this together. Instead of posing yourself as the person who's the authority that's going to deliver the definitive statement on it, and it's over with when you're done, you know, that puts an incredible pressure on you, and it increases this anxiety that I'm talking about. If, on the other hand, we start thinking about sharing ideas, we start thinking about talking with people, if we start thinking about the fact that what's going on is a pattern of stimulus and response that I am inducing, there's a whole theory of communication analysis that's called the induction theory. And they use as their model the simple transformer. You know, you got this little transformer up next to your doorbell that makes it go bing bong. It's because the bing bong can't take 115 volts of currency. It would blow out the bell. So there's a little transformer in there that steps the current down. And the way a transformer works is that the current is induced on one side, and then on the other side, a sympathetic current gets generated. When you're involved in a conversation, when you're involved in a speech, you know, what you're doing is you're inducing responses from the other person. It's like you go on this incredible mode of adaption. Like what I'm saying is getting, it's working good over here. I have their attention. Let me go back over here. Let me talk to this group, get their attention again. This guy is nodding. Let me focus on this a little bit. And you're adapting and you're working with the responses that you're getting from the people that you're speaking to or the person that you're speaking to. You're not holding forth. I read a wonderful, I found this book. If you see it in the bookstore, you should get it. It's called The Portable Curmudgeon. And it's all of these quotes, curmudgeon-y type statements from men and women. And this one quote says that a bore is a person who shifts the topic of conversation back to themselves faster than you can, you know. And I think when we think about, you know, talking with people, the way it usually happens is that one person holds forth, and then the other person is sitting there waiting for an opportunity to fit in. I know what I'm going to say when I get my turn, you know, instead of getting involved in a conversation that has an ebb and a flow, and you're reacting to what the other person is doing, and you're going with the natural changes and flowing in the conversation. Now, in a trial situation, you've got to control that flow a little bit more, to be sure, but with just a little bit of forethought, you can make it sort of happen. Now, lawyers, when I've consulted on about 20 trials now, and when lawyers first get me involved in trials, they think that what I'm going to do is show them where to stand in the courtroom and how to gesture so that they can be persuasive, and when to raise their voice and when to lower their voice. You know, they think I'm going to orchestrate things for them like that. And what I start with is, what do you want to say? What do you feel good about saying? What do you want to say? Let's go from there. You know, and when you're saying this, think about maybe saying it this way. Think about maybe using these words instead of those words to color and vivify the story. You know, and I work with witnesses to try and get witnesses to understand that in a direct examination, we can't ask you about your father and mother, but you might be able to bring that up, which is terrific. You know, in this recent case, we had a doctor on the stand, and I thought, gee, an articulate defendant. Well, it's terrific. We got a guy who can talk about himself. And we talked about how important his education and background and degrees would be and where he went to school, trying to create the picture for the jury that this is a man of the community. This is a man who was born and raised in a community. He grew up in it. He went to medical school. He came back to it to practice. Got a sense of responsibility, a sense of commitment, a sense of purpose for that community. At trial, doctor, were you born and raised in Chicago? Answer, yes. You know, witnesses blow up on you, but you've got to think about the way that you can develop and vivify and express what it is you want about that person. You know, and about that, and think about that from, again, getting the focus off yourself. You're putting the focus on him. You've got a witness who can star, and you're saying, look at him, don't look at me, I got too many other things going on. And you're putting that focus on him to let it unfold. Language is probably your biggest tool, and you need to really be conscious in your use of it. Here's the way it works. Something happens. Whatever happens gives us a feeling. The feeling leads to a thought. The thought leads to words. What lawyers do is something happens, they go to words. They try to shortcut that whole process, and they forget about the color value of words. They forget about how things need to be vivified in language. And we end up with words like, when did you exit the vehicle? Ah, you know, when did you get out of your car? At what point in time did you enter the 7-Eleven? When did you go to the 7-Eleven? You know, what did you see when you got there? What, if anything, did you notice? You know, We tend to use those lawyerly things, and it's great for the record, but it has nothing to do with what gets people involved in the communication. And at trial, it's about people. It's about the people on the stand talking to the people in the box, and it's not about what makes a good record. Now, I admit And I understand how you guys get warped. You know, law professors write for law journals and they use a certain kind of language. And then you talk to other lawyers who read that kind of language. And you go to court and you talk to judges who talk in terms of opinions and legal. You know, and the world that you live in is very warped in terms of the kind of language that you need to be expressive. I like to think of it this way. A lawyer needs two languages. You need the language of the people, and you need the language of the court. And when you turn to the bench and you're going to make an argument about an objection, or you're going to give the grounds for an objection, or you're going to argue why the objection shouldn't be sustained, you better be able to do the legal rap. But then when you turn back and you're looking at the witness stand, get out of the legal rap and use language that is vivid and creates a picture. Imagistic language is really what the jury hangs on to. It's what dominates their thinking when they try to put ideas together about the case. You know? But when you just state it in terms of legal jargon, it's not there. It's not there. You know? When you step out, I'm probably going to step on everybody in the room's toes right now when I say this about opening statements and final argument. Everybody has their way of doing it. You talk to lawyers and they say with their greatest pomp, you got to talk about the law somewhere. And I like to start out with a thank you and remind them of their civic responsibility. And then, you know, really, I like to just hold them to the promises that they made during voir dire. And then once I've got them committed to those again, I talk about, and they get into their formula for final argument, you know. And, my thought is, yeah, you got to do that stuff. But what happens in that most propitious moment when you stand up? You're the focus of attention, and everybody is waiting for you to do something. You stand up and you say, my client and I would like to thank you for exercising your civic responsibility and sitting here attentively throughout the many weeks of this trial. We know that it has been a burden on you and your family, and we are deeply grateful. Now let's look at the facts in the case. Let's look at the witness, and you go through this, you know? What happens if you come out at that moment, and do something that hooks them emotionally, that gets your theme and theory of the case right out front again? You know, the words that you use at that moment are dynamite. You know, try this. Ladies and gentlemen, the word incredible has taken on a new meaning than when it was first thought of to be used at a trial. Incredible. We hear sportscasters say that was an incredible play, or wasn't that an incredible game? It almost means great. Wasn't that a great catch? Wasn't that a great throw? Wasn't that an incredible endeavor? Well, the meaning in the law is somewhat different, somewhat more literal, and somewhat old-fashioned. Incredible means without credibility, without weight, without merit. And I would like you to keep that definition in mind when I talk to you about how incredible these witnesses are. And I would like you to keep that definition in mind when I say to you, it's incredible that the prosecutor thought he had a case against so-and-so. You got them. They're thinking, wow, incredible. I'm going to hear that word. And then every time you come to the word incredible, a little neon buzzer goes off in their head. And you set it there, and you're using it, and you're hammering it, but without, you know, being bashing on it. And you're just doing it in a conversational way. And you're setting up something for them to respond to listen to become involved with. And not just sitting there, you're not asking them to just sit there and weigh the evidence. See what I'm getting at? The language that you use is the final part of this physical expressiveness. You're integrated. You're comfortable. You've put yourself at ease. You've done everything in the courtroom to make yourself as congruent as you possibly can. You're flowing through it. Your body language is yours. You're using language that you're comfortable with using. I'm not suggesting that you should, fall into the vernacular and become a street person and do your pimp role as you walk into court. I'm not saying that you should do any of that. But what I am saying is that you've got to find your way of expressiveness and then get comfortable with it and make sure that it's expressive of everything that you're trying to communicate. So the integration that we're talking about in terms of the elements of the case comes right down to how well you get integrated with the ideas that you're trying to put across and the language that you use to do it. And the gestures are part of the language. If you become involved in what you're doing, your gestures follow naturally. Or do you think that I sat up in my hotel room last night and worked out all of this? Come on. Nobody could do it. No one could orchestrate it to that detail, to that amount of detail. When you're involved and your voice is committed, your gestures follow. There's a part, years ago, they used to teach voice and speech as articulation. And they would do the stentorian stuff. And as the behaviorists have gotten more and more involved with the teaching of voice and speech, they talk more now about the development of the vocal gesture, because they found that the part of the brain that stimulates speech is the same part of the brain that stimulates motion. The signal comes from the same area, so that when you're prompted to speak, 9 times out of 10, you're prompted to move. And if you just allow those two things to integrate and to move outward, they'll happen together. We have a guy in Chicago who runs a Ford dealership. His name is Al Pamonte. And Al comes on television late at night to do his own TV commercials. And Al is my example of a totally unintegrated presenter. Because he says things physically, he's a half a beat behind his verbal expression. So he'll say, "Hi, my name is Al Pamonte, and I run the Ford dealership." It's like he's just that far off. And the first couple of times I saw his commercials, I thought that they didn't get the audio track and the video track meshed. And he was just that far behind, Somebody told him that to be expressive, he should use his hand. So he used his hands, but it wasn't integrated with what he was saying. I love to watch children, because children are the most integrated. A couple of years ago, my daughter is 3, and a year and a half ago, around Christmas time, we're in a store, and she saw a rubber duck. Now, she's got more bath toys than you can imagine, but she saw this rubber duck. It's got 5 rubber ducks. They all look alike. She picked up this rubber duck and she looked at me and she said, "Dad, I need it." And the way she said "need" came from her toes, And it was like, whoa, this is really committed. I'm going to have to deal with this want, And I said, "Kate, we have several of those. Don't you remember?" And then finally she put it down. But the connection to what she wanted and the physical involvement with what she was doing, dynamite. As we get older, we get away from that kind of connection. When she was an infant, and she doesn't cry very much anymore, but when she was a little tiny baby, I was amazed at my ability to suddenly distinguish between crying for hunger, crying for comfort, crying for change, crying for this different cries. They're connected to that stuff. "I want this," and it comes out. We suddenly say, "I want this, but I better not let anybody know I want this. So I think I'll put it through this screen. I'll filter it this way, and I'll say it this way." And it gets, the impulse to speak gets removed from what we actually say, or what we actually say gets removed from the impulse to speak. And what I'm, I guess what I'm saying about this physical expressive stuff, or expressiveness stuff, is you got to get back in touch with the impulse to speak if you're going to find a comfortable range of gesture, if you're going to find a way to be, to modulate, to go up and down in what you're saying, or to use gesture. You can't have the impulse to speak and then think about it and filter it and push it through 32 screens and then judge it and evaluate it and wonder, what are they thinking? What are they going to think if I do this? If they think that, then I better be ready to do this. And you're going, and you're nuts by the time you say, objection. You know, yeah. What are you laughing at? Isn't it true? Isn't it true? Isn't that what we get somebody? I mean, what's the ultimate objection? Fair, Your Honor. That's really what you're saying. He can't do that. That's not fair. But what do we say? Objection, Your Honor, Rule 3307. You know, and it comes out like we're some kind of robot. No. So we have to think about getting in touch with the impulse to speak and getting our witnesses to the point where they are in touch with the impulse to speak. When you're putting somebody on in direct and allowing that person to know that his impulse to talk about the events from his point of view is totally valid and absolutely what you want him to do. We're going to go into this area, and we're going to go into this area, and we're going to go into this area, you know. And when we talk about this, I want to remind you that what you told me when we talked about that was boom, 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 you know. And let him know how that all fits together. And you've got the building blocks that you're going to slide so that his testimony becomes one increment of persuasion, one piece of persuasion that goes along. In cross-examination, I think cross-examination is a missed opportunity in terms of physical expressiveness. Okay? What are we afraid of the most in cross-examination? That the guy's going to talk. So what happens? The guy talks. Our worst fears get realized, right? I think that there's a way to go about cross-examination that's expressive of where you're going, allows you to score points, and allows you to have a physical attitude about what's going on. I call it the big mo, you know. Once you get the momentum going, you don't want anything to happen with it. And then this afternoon, we'll talk about what I call the evidence dance when we talk about the jury-centered courtroom. But think about, may I borrow this? In cross-examination, you've got a piece of paper, whether it's the codicil to a will, whether it's an addendum to a contract, whether it's a confession, whatever it is, you know, you have an attitude towards this piece of paper. And sometimes your attitude towards this piece of paper is going to be that it's not worth the paper it's been printed on. And you're going to handle it in such a way that people will know how you feel about it. You know, and you don't have to get so carried away that you better pack your toothbrush, you know, and get the judge really ticked at you. But you can communicate an attitude toward, and there are other times when this piece of paper is next to the Magna Carta in its importance. And the way in which you handle it, the way in which you present it to the witness who's going to identify it and use it, gives it all of the weight and authority and power that it needs to have. See, there's a physical connection with the prop that lets people know what you think about it. What we get instead is, just a minute, Your Honor. Do you have that? Where is that? I put the post-it on the edge of it. Where is it? You know, and you get this fumble and mumble for the document that takes the momentum away from what you're doing. And then when it's produced, it's sort of like, what the hell is that? What has that got to do with anything? But you could make the jury want to read that baby. You know, this is important to your case. You get up and you move over to opposing counsel table. If it's the way you do it down here, you know, and you show it to him, you know, Malcolm, I'm going to show them the records from the doctor's office now. Is that okay with you? They want to see it. See how he's nodding? He bought into it. You know, if I come over and say, this is that stuff we talked about the other day, it's okay, right? You know, he's going to go, yeah, yeah. And they're not going to be interested in it. You know, the way you go to opposing counsel, whether you have it marked before you get to the courtroom, the way you deal with this baby, you know, especially if you're using it for impeachment, you know, this is the deposition that you're now going to hang that person with. This is important. This is the document. And there was a reporter present, a recorder present when you made these statements, and you were under oath when you said them. You know, wow, wait, wait, wait. And your relationship to this becomes dynamite. And even when you don't have a document, there's got to be, I think everybody's got to develop what I call the Ralph Cramden approach to cross-examination. You got to have a look. I believe you got to have a look that says to the guy, are you kidding me? You know, remember how Cramden used to go, you know, and he would, you know, he'd give you that stuff. And you knew the minute he did one of his takes that what was to follow was going to be disbelief about what was going on. You're asking the questions and this guy is getting into something that you just are not buying. And you want the jury to know that you are not buying it. I think you've got to have a physical expression that says, what? Without saying what. Now, you've got to find the line. I'm not suggesting that anybody get the judge ticked. You know, you've got to find your way of doing that that allows for you to express your attitude to the jury. You know? And it could come across. You can have an attitude that lets them know so much more than the words that you're saying. Podiums. Everybody talks about podiums. Should I stay behind the podium or should I not stay behind the podium? A lot of jurisdictions, the judge makes you stay behind the podium, right? And at least up in Illinois. What I suggest is, see if I can turn this around without spilling my Coke. Think about this as an image the next time you think about standing behind a podium. This is what I call the wooden dress. Okay. I am now wearing the wooden dress from my sternum to the floor. There is no way that I can be me behind this podium. Think about how much it cuts off. Think about how stiff it is. Think about how, you know, you really got to work out behind here to overcome this. And what happens when we get behind it, those of you in the back will have a little trouble seeing my feet on this, but we get what I call, and it's not a gender issue, ladies, it's a syndrome called little girl feet, you know, where you do this. I was watching a lady in the appellate court stand, she had high heels on, and her ankles were on the floor because she had rolled so far over. And she was, nobody can see me, so I'm going to do this doo-doo behind the podium. And you start to lose your power to speak. What I think you got to do is you got to get out from behind the podium. You've got to get away from it so that you can be seen. And when you're seen, you have a better opportunity to be expressive. If the judge thinks that the minute you get out from behind the podium, you're going to run around the court with a machine gun and become a terrorist, you have to educate him. You have to let them know that you're safe. So maybe you take a walk out this side and you talk for a little bit, but you keep your hand on it, you know, and you come back and you get another idea and you cross out this way, you know, and you're right at the podium, but you're using the podium and you're not getting away from the podium. And then once he's convinced that you don't have hand grenades and bombs, you can get away from the podium and take a walk on the wild side, but not too much, you know, Mickey. Let it go and let him see that just because you've left the podium, you're not going to kill it. And then you get back to it, you know. And then by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you'll be able to, you know, you'll be able to just stay sort of tangentially connected to it. But I really believe that you need to get away from the podium so that you, the expressiveness of your body can be seen and your involvement with what you're doing becomes expressed through your body. I see people, you know, in court draping themselves on the podium, asking the most crucial point of their cross-examination, laying down on this baby, you know? It's like it's a couch. And somehow you're supposed to be convincing the jury that you're interested in this guy's testimony. During direct examination, what Steve Wrench called gardening occurs, okay? You've been through the testimony a gazillion times. You know exactly what's going to be said. You ask the question, you know, and thank you. And when you went into the 7-Eleven, would you tell us what you saw? And because you know what's coming, you do this. And they're talking. You know, this is your testimony. It's important to your case. And you're gardening in your notes. You're arranging the peas and getting the carrots together. And you're doing this paperwork. Some lawyers, it's really bad. You know, they put one foot up on the step that's down here and they start doing clothing stuff. I look okay. How do you look interested in the testimony that's going on when you're doing that? And I think that being behind the podium allows you to hide. It allows you to fall into those traps of, you know, get out of there. Expose yourself. Here I am. You know, this is what I look like. This is what it means to me. And if you're not held in there by any court ruling, you know, by anything in your jurisdiction or any judge's whim, get out of there and start moving away from that podium. You'll notice that what I did with the podium when I came in here this morning was I turned it to the side. I need a place to put my notes. I'm not going to try to pretend that I don't. But I want my notes to be part of what I'm saying. So I keep my stuff organized this way. And then I can get out and I can move. And I'm never trying to wear the wooden dress. I'm never trying to step back here and say, don't look at me. You know, here I am. This is what I'm saying. Here's the stuff we're going through. And you can keep it organized that way. Question, physical expressiveness. Ask me, tell me where is your tension hit itself? Where does it manifest itself in you? Maybe we can talk about how to get rid of it. How do you like this one? When you stand up, you've got your page of questions and there's a moment of silence in the courtroom and all you hear is, does that rattle your cage a little bit? Put it down. Don't hold it if it does that. Or hold a bunch of them so they can't do it together, you know? Put it on a clipboard, put it in a folder. If that happens to you, you know. Just, yes, ma'am.
Mark, you remember
that the
I cannot
tough. Yeah, you got to, it's interesting you can say that because the lawyer that I just worked on this case with in Illinois is confined to a motorized cart because of a muscular dystrophy illness. And he's physically handicapped, but he's incredibly animated. You know, I think if you're confined to the chair, first of all, I would try to get a bunch of affidavits from psychologists and other lawyers and do some educating on those judges to make sure that getting out of your chair, you know, I mean, if you got to go for Sixth Amendment stuff, you know, I can't try this case sitting down. You're preventing me from doing effective care. Do something to educate the judges. But if you have to stay in the chair, you know, I think you got to work that chair. You've got to, you know, you can't ever allow the inertia of the chair to become the ruling force. You've got to, you know, work it, use it, be animated from within the chair so that the chair, you know, if you've got to stay in here, but then use the chair, you know, it should be barely support for your bottom. You know, you're on your legs, you're like a catcher. You're almost in a squat position and you're ready to deal with anything that's coming up and you're animated and you're using the chair and you turn and you pivot and it should become apparent to everybody in the room that you don't want to be in that chair. Think of what this does to your energy. You know, not to mention the catastrophe on your discs, you know, all that pressure going down. Stand up. And if you absolutely have to stay in a chair, use it, work it. You know, pull it into the desk, push it out from the desk. Make him know that this chair is going to become your prop. You know, and if you could, I'm still in the chair. I'm still on the chair. I haven't violated any rule. I'm still on my chair. You know, if you, that's extreme to be sure, but you really want to make it known that you're being forced to stay in that chair. And I certainly would, there's got to be behavioral psychologists and trial consultants around the country who would do affidavits for you that say communication is best effected from a standing position. And, you know, make it a bar association issue if you don't want to take the judge on. Why is this guy making us sit down? And what can we do to re-educate him about that practice in his courtroom and have the bar association, you know, bring it up? It may take months to work out, but at least they will know that you are not just going along with the ritual because that's the way it should go along. Up in Illinois, whenever we talk about the voir dire portion of a trial, we have to talk about we don't get to do it at all. And we have to talk about the need to re-educate the judges. You know, we always get the, in the interest of time, counsel, I'll ask the question. You know, if you're prejudiced and unfair, would you please raise your hands? You know, that's kind of the questioning that goes on. And we have to continually battle the judges. I mean, it is so bad. I've been to a bunch of trials in Chicago and I've worked on a bunch of trials. A year ago, October, I was in Washington, D.C., and I was watching a friend of mine do a closing argument in a rape case, and the jury came back in for final argument, and I was struck by the fact that there were 12 black people in the jury. In Illinois, we don't get black people on the jury because the judges ask the questions, you know, and people get excluded. And when I saw that in D.C., I said, holy moly, we have a way to go. We've got to get this voir dire thing back into like where it needs to be so that people are getting tried by their peers. You know, real important stuff. And then the judge, oh, no, counsel, he'll be fair. He can be fair. You know. Oh, your uncle just got run over by a train. That won't bother you. What? You know, and we're off into the case. And I think that educating the judges is part of the trial lawyer's responsibility. You know, I think a neatly folded copy of the Sixth Amendment should be in everybody's back pocket or briefcase. And you should have the wherewithal to waive it when you can, to let the judges know that this is something that you have to do to effectively represent your client. And I think that's real important. But then I told you earlier that I have a thing about the system. I love going up against it. Yes.
What about eye contact? They see you make eye contact continuously.
Eye contact.
Jury.
The boogeyman of eye contact. It's absolutely essential to the jury. Eye contact is absolutely essential. But again, it's not a prescriptive matter. I read a thing where somebody was saying that 10 seconds of eye contact is good. 10 seconds. Let's do 10 seconds. That's 5. Can you imagine looking at some poor SOB for 10 seconds? He would feel like, oh, what do I got? Warts? What's he looking at? You know, who can say that it's long enough? You know, that's an incredible amount of time. The TV commercial that I talked about is a 30-second spot. Think of what can be accomplished in 10 seconds. Somebody could run 100 yards in 10 seconds, and you're going to stare at one person just to prove you're friendly. It's going to increase self-consciousness. Here's what I think about when you approach the jury rail and you're going to do eye contact. Work in a diamond, okay, so that, you know, they usually very artistically stagger the seats so the people in the back row can look through the heads of the people in the front row. Well, if you look at that, you've got a nice little triangular arrangement there. Then you move over and you've got a nice little triangular diamond shape arrangement. And use 3 people at a time. And let your eye move comfortably. And then when you've got those 3, move over to the next three. And you're working the rail, and you're using three people at a time, but you're not riveting one person with your good intentions. It could really make somebody feel very uncomfortable. I think eye contact is absolutely essential. If you have difficulty with it, here's an exercise. I think it really works. It's what I call shooting down the hands. And it works. Get some of your colleagues or your wife or your church group or whatever, put them together in a room, but spread them out. Okay? And then start practicing your opening and closing with the instruction that when they feel as though you've lost contact with them, they should raise their hand. And the minute you look at them, their hand goes down and you don't break the flow of what you're doing. So you're into what you're saying and you're talking and a hand goes up and then you go back to the other hand and you're just constantly moving. And initially it's going to feel like crazy man, you know, but eventually what you start doing is sweeping the group. And you linger long enough to make sure this group feels as though they have contact. And then you come back to this group. Whoops, did I lose something over here? And you come back to this group. You come back to this group. And you come back to this group. Never underestimating the amount of energy that it takes to fill a room full of people. You've got to fill with a lot of energy to get people to focus on you. There's no doubt about it. But when you're doing this kind of movement eye contact, and you're aware of everything, but you can't let it interrupt you. Remember back in my hippie days, I tried to do transcendental meditation. I was terrible. I'm too hyper. You know, I'd try to get into a, and then I would get crazy. I'd start thinking about all of these things. And I talked to the man who was teaching the class, and I'd say, I'm never able to get there. I'm never really able to, like, relax because I start worrying about where I parked the car, whether I'm getting a ticket, did I leave the lights on, my checkbook, my things are turning to rubber, I'm bouncing checks at the bank, what am I doing? Blah, blah, blah. And he said, all of those thoughts will come in. The only time they become an interruption is when you hang on to them. You know, and I watch lawyers in court, and I'm amazed at their ability to carry on with all of the stuff that goes on in a courtroom. Somebody ought to give the bailiff a smack on the head. He's over there doing crossword puzzles, you know, blowing his nose, doing all of this stuff, talking to people, sending messages back and forth. Other lawyers coming in and out of the courtroom to watch what's going on, the judge, you know, nodding and being awakened, you know, doing all of this stuff. And lawyers sort of go on and just play over all of this. And I think that that's a wonderful tribute to the ability to concentrate. You know, have you ever seen a judge when somebody gets really worked up about an objection and they scream, "Object, Your Honor," and the judge goes, oh. They get startled. You know, God knows where they were. They zoned out for a minute, you know, just, yeah. Your ability to concentrate is real. I don't like to think about concentration. I like to think about awareness. So that your awareness goes out into the room and you become aware of everything that's going on, but you don't concentrate on everything. Okay? If I concentrate on the fact that people coming in and out of the doors bothers me, you know, every time somebody comes in and out of the door, I'm going to be bothered. If I concentrate on the fact that people writing bothers me because I can't make eye contact with them, every time somebody takes a note, I'm going to get bothered. But instead, you say, okay, she's writing now, he's leaving now, maybe he's got to make a phone, maybe he's got to go to the bathroom. Oh, he's having coffee, he's having a drink, that person back there just stood up, maybe they don't like sitting down. And you're aware of everything that's going on, but you don't let it throw you. When you're concentrating, it sort of implies that an interruption is about to happen. When I think of concentration, I think of Uri Geller. Remember Uri Geller from the 60s? He used to bend spoons with his mind. You know, he'd look at a spoon, and then it would bend. That's concentration. Who needs it? You know? When have you ever been asked to move a spoon with your mind? I don't think I've ever. I'm 45. Nobody's ever asked me to do that. You know, but if you think in terms of just allowing your concentration to your awareness to go out into the room, you're aware of everything that's going on. If it becomes something that you can use, you know, sometimes I'll stand very still and I'll just try to watch everything that's going on with my peripheral vision and stuff. And you're amazed at the things that you see. And then when you point out to somebody, you know, that they just did something, they go, oh my God, I didn't know you could see me. Your awareness can go out. Yes, sir.
Lord, give me or him us the direction on how to deflect the focus off of the warrior onto the witness. When you talked a little bit about that earlier, it seems that at the time you want the focus to be also on the witness, not necessarily on you, the warrior. Doing great, or you're voting on emotion, and all the jury's looking at you, but are they listening to what's been said? Or is that important?
Well, I think it's important at different times. You know, I mean, there are certain times when you want, like what, if I'm working on a cross-examination, I don't want any attention on the witness. You know, I want to, my analogy for the game, for cross-examination is that very first video game that came out, it was called Pong, you know, where this white blip came down on the screen and you had to move the thing around and block it from going off the screen. Well, that's what I think you do in cross-examination. You're constantly interrupting the witness's focus on the jury. You don't want them talking there. But when it's your witness and you want that story to unfold, I think that you calm yourself down and you get out of the way. But about 10 years ago, somebody wrote in some trial advocacy book that direct examination is the time for the lawyer to get out of the way. And a good way to do that is for the lawyer to position himself at the end of the jury box and ask questions from that position so that the witness will take the jury into his view as he speaks with the lawyer. So what happens? You've got this witness on the stand that's sort of shaky and a little bit scared and nervous about being in court, and then you very dutifully pick up your legal pad, walk to the end of the jury box, and start lobbing questions like mortar shells from over here. That witness feels like he's totally disenfranchised. He has nothing to do with the proceedings, and he gets more nervous. I agree that that's a good place to end up, but you got to end up there. So those preliminary questions where you're not into really what happened and you're bringing up some background and you're putting him in a time and place sort of setting, creating a foundation for his testimony, allowing it to happen, and you're gradually moving away, you're gradually getting further away, you're gradually getting further away, and then he's comfortable, his voice is filling the room, and finally you end up over there and you're ready to get into the substantive part of your direct, where the focus should be on him and his view of the jury is important. But lawyers are just such a literal-minded group. Somebody said, go to the end of the jury box, and I'll be darned, that's where they're going. They pick up their pad, and they head for that like it's a pulpit or something. And the poor witness is like, do I know you? You were more friendly last night when we talked. You know, and so I think that there are times when your lack of motion puts the focus on the witness. And the way you ask the questions gets the witness to pull the focus of the jury to him. Yes, ma'am.
Stay correct and really pull emotion out of it. It also really pep up something, and it seems you know something like forgetfully reading.
The question is there a book or a technique on how to draw emotions out of people? I don't think so. I think that you push buttons. You talk to the actor about the points of identification that they have with the character. You talk to the actor about the circumstances under which the lines are being spoken, and then you launch into it. You know, so if I'm directing somebody in a scene, I might say, you know how powerless you feel when you go to traffic court and the guy's looking down at you and he says, do you plead guilty? And then you don't have anything to say. You can't even say, but I didn't mean to make the turn. You can't say a word and you just tie in to talk. I want you to think about that while you say these lines. And that's what I'll do to put the person in the circumstances. I don't know that you have the opportunity to do that at trial, you know, but what you can do is you can paint the picture through the questions. You can create the time and place setting. You can really create the ambiance of what's going on. And then when the person tells you what they did, it all fits, and it's that fitting together. I think that there are some things that you can do in terms of coaching. You've got a woman whose children were just wiped out at a railroad crossing because the gates didn't work, you know. And even though the accident occurred a long time ago, this is a hot spot for her. She's ticked off at the railroad for not putting in the proper kind of signal. She's grieved at having lost her children, you know. And you know, because you've talked to her umpteen times, that every time you get into this area, she wells up with tears and she starts to cry. I suggest that you leave that area alone, that you don't rehearse her in that area. Because the more she talks about it, the more inured she's going to get, the easier it's going to be to deal with that. And then it'll come off like, so what you do when you're working with her is you say, and after we talk about this area and how all the people in the neighborhood complained, I'm going to talk to you about the signals that didn't work, okay? And don't go any further with it. And you know that when you get to that point in the direct, that's an emotional button that you're going to push for the impact that it's going to have on the jury. But you don't rehearse her in it. You know, a friend of mine was working on an arson murder case in which all of the publicity in the papers was that this woman torched her house to kill her husband. And that's what the publicity in the paper was, that she was a murderer, so on. You know, the whole direct started to come out about how there had been a party, he got drunk, he was flirting with another woman, she was angry, he passed out on the bed, she was standing there with a cigarette trying to talk to him, she lit a cigarette and he wasn't responding, she threw the match on the floor and she walked out. Last question is, did you mean to kill him? And she just lost her beans in front of the jury. Compelling testimony that you couldn't rehearse, that you could not push the button in practice. You couldn't coach that witness towards that emotional response. You've got to be sensitive to where it is and bring everybody up to that point and know when you're going to push the button. And then, but don't practice it. I really don't think you should practice it, because if it looks glib, if it looks rehearsed, opposing counsel is going to jump all over it. And the jury's probably not going to believe it. You know, also, I think that you have to decide where in the testimony you're going to do that. She's my witness, and I know she's going to lose her beans when I talk about the railroad crossing. You know, I'm going to do the railroad crossing button right before he gets up to talk to her. You deal with it, you know, so that when he gets up to do his cross-examination of this very sympathetic witness, she's in tears, and he's got to do the, would you like a glass of water, you know, kind of thing to get it back on track so he can start the cross-examination. I mean, you've really got to think about how those things go together and how you're going to use them. What happens is lawyers get excited. I got a great witness. She's going to tell a great story. She's really going to wail. They get up and they go for the whole wad right away. And then they haven't developed it. They haven't put it in a context. They haven't put it in a setting that starts to make sense. And that's going to be part of the storytelling thing that we'll get into this afternoon. I want to start this afternoon talking about storytelling. This is a somewhat new topic for me, and I've been doing a lot of research on it in the past couple of years. And it's really fascinating, because storytelling is a dying art form, yet there are thousands of storytellers who travel the country telling stories. And I go sometimes to listen at storytelling conventions and see what I could glean and grab and use from people. But they're a very weird lot. And I have to confess up front that what I have to say about storytelling is only tangentially connected to the ritual and folklore of great storytellers. There's not much written about storytelling. You can find good stories that people have told, but great storytellers don't ever write them down, because they believe that the art of the story is in the telling, and that what happens between you and the audience while the story is going on is what makes the story. And there's all of this lore about stories. I did find one book that's used at Northwestern University called The Craft and technique of storytelling. It's about yay thick and sells for $45. It's like a law textbook. It's all about story structure and how stories go together. And I'm chipping my way through this, trying to, you know, glom onto an idea or a theory and then trying it and practicing it and using it. Storytelling is something that lawyers all tend to agree is important in terms of a trial, but very few really know how to use in terms of a trial. Most people think when we talk about storytelling that what we're talking about is the colorful anecdote that you tell right before closing argument, or the colorful analogy that you build before you say, and now let's look at the state's case. You know, and what I want to do is try and get you to think about storytelling as something other than the point of adding color to the story, the point of more than just spicing it up for the sake of the jury. The popular notion that, he's a great storyteller, usually means that at some point in final argument, counsel can unbutton his coat and say, that reminds me of the time, and go into something. I'd like to shake us off that and get you to start thinking about the whole trial as a story that unfolds from the beginning right through the end of final argument. And that when you stand up in final argument, you're just really putting the epilogue on the story. You're not fashioning the story at that moment. And when you stand up in opening statement, you're doing the prologue to your story, but you're not shooting the whole wad at that point either. One of the things that I usually recommend that people do is go home to your library and dust off that anthology of Shakespearean plays that you haven't looked at since sophomore year in college, and take out a copy of Romeo and Juliet and read the prologue to Romeo and Juliet. It's a terrific opening statement because it tells about a whole story that's going to evolve without giving away any of the story. It sets the stage in a way that allows the rest of the story to unfold. It sets the stage in a way that lets you know who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. It sets the stage in a way to let you know where the conflict is going to be. But it doesn't characterize it in any way, and it doesn't steal any of its own thunder so that the story is ready to happen. When you're done with the prologue, you're ready for the beginning, and you want to see how it will turn out. You know? And that's the way I like to think about the trial. The trial is constantly unfolding in story fashion. And there are themes and there are moments of foreshadowing and irony that get developed throughout the trial, and they're constantly humming on. The arrangement of your witnesses during your case in chief, how you are going to put on the most important witnesses in the most persuasive order to tell the story from your point of view. And if the direct, or as you're putting on your case, the direct examinations all do that in a certain way. And it just takes a little bit of time to think about it. There are a couple of functions that stories have served throughout time. And that is, the major one is that stories always have helped people understand social action. And then because of that, it makes the trial an opportune moment or an ideal opportunity for storytelling. People organize things in terms of stories. I'll use my daughter again. If Kate only knew she got talked about so much while I'm out of town, she wouldn't feel so bad about my going out of town. My three-year-old loves stories. You know, she'll say, you know, at night when I'm putting her to sleep, I'll read a story and I'll say, good night, honey. And she'll say, Daddy, tell me what I did today. And I'll tell it to her in a story form. Well, this morning when we got up, you watched Sesame Street while I read the paper or, you know, whatever happened. And I'll put it together in a narrative. And she's absolutely rapt. She stares at me with this, like, yeah, did I do that? Did I have a good time? She wants to hear it in a story fashion. And what she's doing, what the developmental psychologists tell us that those youngsters are doing when they hear stories, is they're learning how to organize reality. They're learning how to put shape to experience. They're learning how to understand social action. Adults have the same need to understand the context for social action. And the more story-like we could make that context, or the more of a story we can tell in shaping that context, the more compelling it is to the person who's listening. We're constantly telling stories. We, you know, your next door neighbor goes on vacation. He comes back. You say, hey, Bill, how was the trip? He tells you a story, right? He says, what happened while I was gone? You tell him a story. I mean, everything unfolds in terms of a story. And what's very fascinating to me, I mentioned this earlier, is the complexity with which we're able to handle things like plot. The way we're able to keep a number of elements juggled and going on in the air, as long as there's a unifying element or theme. Let's stick with Bill's vacation, okay? You say, Bill, how was the vacation? He doesn't say, Joe, it was fine. We left Saturday morning at 8:35 and drove for approximately 2 hours, at which point we pulled into a Denny's. I had pancakes. The kids had malted silver dollar. You know, he doesn't give it to you in a narrative. He doesn't give it to you. I mean, he gives it to you in a narrative. He doesn't give it to you in a linear progression. He says, oh, it was great. We got to my in-law's house and we had a terrific time. And we went on this little trip down. Though we had a flat tire and it was terrible because, but I'll tell you about that later. And then when we got to Disney World, we did this, and you know, and he goes through and he tells you bits and pieces and fragments. The unifying element is this is about Bill's vacation, and it comes in bits and pieces, and eventually, you're holding this piece of information about the flat tire until he can work it back into the story, and you're holding this bit of information about the argument that he had with his father-in-law until it fits into a context within the story. And the unifying element is the family vacation, and you're hanging on to that theme, but the different parts of the plot are coming in a different way. And we're very sophisticated in our ability to keep the plot open-ended as long as we've got a through line that we eventually tie it into. Same thing happens at a trial. The jury is amazingly sophisticated at being able to keep pieces of the case afloat until you tie them back in. But you've got to tie them back in. You can't just leave them out there. A lot of times when you set up your witness call, you're at the mercy of their schedules, and you're not going to get this witness to come at this time, and you're not going to get, it would be nice if you could get them all to happen in a certain order, but that gets torn up on you, and this witness comes in later, and this witness comes in earlier. But there's no need to panic, because you can put all of it into a context, unify it by a theme, and the jury knows how to tie it together. We're amazingly sophisticated in terms of stories. And another way in which I like to use Homer. Remember the Iliad and the Odyssey and the blind poet Homer who told these sagas? Well, when we're talking about how stories help us understand social action or interaction, I think about it in terms of Homer. Here's this guy who's wandering around ancient Greece blind. Now, things are not too great for blind people in the latter part of the 20th century. Can you imagine what it was like then? You know, natural perils, you walk off a cliff, you know, you can get mugged, you could get robbed, you could get preyed upon by any number of circumstances or individuals. This guy comes into a castle and gets fed and put up for the night because of the stories that he tells. And what does the story have to deal with? Has to deal with this great hero who's a wanderer, Odysseus. And Odysseus wanders around hoping that the people he bumps into will be kind to him. What's the blind man talking about? He's saying, hey, don't do bad things to me because I can't see you. There was this guy, Ulysses, you know, he was on a trip one time and he was wandering around and he didn't know where he was going. And this king really tried to mess with him. And look what happened to the king. And he stumbled into this cave where this big monster tried to take advantage of him. And look what he did to the monster. And what Homer is saying to the people that he's telling this story to is, don't mess with me. Because just like the bad guys in the story, bad things are going to happen to you if you mess with me. The barbarian kings are saying, oh, there's something in this. You know, we better be nice to this guy because you know what can happen. The clouds can open up. The gods could really rain on your parade. We better be cool. This guy knows what he's talking about. He was able to get them to identify his circumstance, and he was talking about a fictitious kind of behavior that enabled him to get treated well by the people that he was dealing with. Now, there probably was a Ulysses, and there probably was a, you know, an Odyssey of some sort and all that. We don't really know. It's just interesting history, lore, it all meshes together. The point is that as a storyteller, Homer was able to exploit the myth to his own advantage by making an analogous situation with the social action of the people in the story to dictate the social action that he wanted to go on in the castle or household that he stumbled into. His moral was always the same, or his message was always the same. I'll tell you another chapter of the story. If you feed me, give me a place to sleep, let me chill so I don't have to go back out into the night again, and like it'll be cool. I'll tell you a story for that's the trade-off. And then to ensure his place, he talked about how badly those people in the story got messed over when they weren't kind to the wanderer. And the people are putting the social action into a context that makes them understand it. You know, he happened to be, I'm sure there were lots of people wandering around telling stories. Homer happened to be pretty good at it. Because after how many years when they came to write them down, nobody even bothered to claim ownership for any of the stories. You know, they lived orally for years and years. And then when they wrote the book, they said, oh yeah, that's Homer's book. You know, I mean, he really put his impression on it in terms of a storyteller. So stories are like a real important way to understand our society. You know, and trials are about stories. They're about the way people interact with people. They're about incidents that lead to litigation, and there's no way to get relief. This guy thinks he's right, and this guy thinks he's right. Let each person tell their story, and then we'll make a judgment about which side gets it. And it's really about stories. We've got to think about it that way.
This is the end of tape 3. The program continues on tape 4.